I'm Anthony Walsh and this is the Roadman Podcast, the show where we empower you with the tools to optimize your health, your happiness and your longevity. Today we chat with cycling coach Colly Moore from Empirical Cycling. If you're a detail-orientated person, you're going to enjoy today's deep dive into Zone 2 training, metabolic flexibility and the principles for constructing your own micro and macro training plans. Here's a little taste of what awaits you today.
And so when we're looking at a training plan, and if somebody's got 20 hours to ride, more often than not, I want them riding 20 hours because regardless of the intensity, I know it's going to be more impactful on their endurance performance than if they ride 10, 12, 15. We've got a trade-off between all the levers that you said, like how frequently can we do this? How hard can we do this? How long can we do this? And so I'm always thinking of what's my mechanism of progress? What's the progression thing with each type of interval? If it's like VO2s, you've got to go max. And so the intensity is the stimulus. If it's like threshold or sweet spot, the duration is the stimulus. You know, one of the things about like having a rule of thumb like that is it's a rule of thumb. And once you understand the rule and you start to poke around and say, okay, what works better for me rather than I've got to strictly adhere to this rule, that's when you can start going, all right, maybe I can do 2 sessions a week that are hard, 3 sessions, 4 sessions.
Colly, welcome to the Roadman Podcast.
Anthony, thanks for having me.
I'm excited to chat. Endurance, all things Zone 2. We've seen a massive groundswell of public conversation and discourse around Zone 2 in the past couple of years. What's driving this? Why has it become so popular and so in vogue all of a sudden?
Oh, you're asking me? God, I have no idea, man. I'm just happy people are riding. And in a lot of ways, I think for, what, I don't know, 5 years? I mean, you know, you've been part of this world for so long. Like, how long was super high intensity stuff the thing? And you can imagine how many people burned out on that. And so I'm just kind of happy that there's something that's popular that's like not, you've got to bleed from your eyeballs to make these intervals effective.
Yeah. And you know what? I think we all played into it. Well, when I say we all, I'm holding my hands up and say I played into the high intensity part as well, because you're trying to, at a point in the coaching company, we were trying to find that you want to make coaching and cycling accessible to everybody. And a large chunk of people find themselves time crunched. And when this intensity wave came, the temptation was initially, especially when we didn't understand the limitations of training stress score, to say, well, we can bump training stress score a lot if we just keep cranking that intensity dial. And we hadn't seen the data on the drawbacks of that, but that evolves and people are allowed to change their positions. I always say I have strong opinions held loosely. That's one I definitely hold loosely.
Yeah. I mean, and that's also kind of what we do as coaches too, is that there's a feedback cycle where we're looking for what's the biggest bang for the buck. And, you know, the bang being adaptation and the buck being stress and fatigue. And you want to get somebody as fast as possible without having them burn out or quit or anything like that. And I think that the way that we coach, it really is a testament to having found a good rhythm with that kind of stuff, because we keep clients for years. Like, I mean, usually a lot of people, when they stop working with us, is because they're done cycling. They've got a family now, or, you know, they were in a catastrophic crash, unfortunately. Stuff like that happens. And so you kind of know that you're in the right range when you keep people for a long time and they're happy. And I think also, especially because most people that we coach and that you probably coach, are more casual folks, and they're not looking for, all right, I want to eke out every single watt and I'm going to dedicate my whole life to it. It's like, no, I've got a family, I've got school, I've got work, I've got other stuff to do. And so you're always looking to maximize somebody's investment.
Well, this is a brilliant lens to frame this conversation through, looking at stuff through a long-term lens for a long time, because we have these different levers we can pull. We can pull the lever of frequency, get somebody to train more times during a week. We can pull the duration lever, where we got someone to train for a longer period in a fixed session, or we can pull the intensity lever. We can get people to add more intensity into a given session. And that really determines our total weekly volume. Frequency, duration, intensity is going to give us our total work for the week. But something that's missed in that equation is what you just said. It's the long-term view. It's, I want somebody that's going to be with me, and I want a client that's going to progress over the next decade. Because when we zoom out and we look at it through the lens of a decade, decisions, they're framed slightly differently. Like if I have a little bit of a niggle in my IT band, should I go and do my sweet spot session? Okay, well, if your target event is 2 weeks away and that's your finish line, yeah, maybe you should push through that. But if you're looking at this over the course of a decade, you definitely shouldn't be pushing through that.
Yeah, I mean, and that's, you know, that's kind of another thing in coaching is what is this person's short-term goals and long-term goals? And you've got to meet in the middle between those two. And sometimes you've got to prioritize. Sometimes, you know, if somebody's sick and their A race is coming up and, you know, they're pissing shit for three nights in a row, it's like, you better talk to your client and be like, hey, you should probably deprioritize your expectations for this upcoming race because, you know, I've had stomach bugs before big races. It doesn't go well. It might go well, but you've got to manage somebody's expectations with that kind of stuff for sure.
So we've had physiologists like Pogacar's former coach, Inigo San Millan, and they've been beating the drum for decades and nobody was listening to them about, you need to slow down to go fast. You need to slow down to go fast. Nobody was really listening. And now people have started listening. So at the beginning of this conversation, can you maybe ground some of these terms that we're going to come back to time and time again? Like, what is zone two training and why is it significant for cyclists?
I've had a love-hate relationship with the term zone two for a long time. Because, you know, for a while, I'm a dyed-in-the-wool sprinter, to use myself as an example. And when I started training way back in like 2010, 2011, you know, I first got a power meter and I'm looking at all the Coggin zones and I'm like, okay, if I ride at 120% FTP, I'm going to improve my VO2 max. But I also knew from, you know, scientific literature that like VO2 max is maximal oxygen uptake. I should be sucking wind at this point, right? And I'll go do 3 minutes at 120%. And I'm like, I'm breathing through my nose. This feels easy. I don't know if this is VO2 max. This does not feel like max at all. And so that was the beginning of me going, oh, I think there's something about these zones that's not quite right. And then when you dig into them, you know, Coggin originally meant them to be descriptive rather than prescriptive. And I think that kind of definitional, clinging to, oh, you've got to be between 55 to 75% of FTP for this to work. That's where zone two, quote unquote, really for me starts to lose it because your first threshold, your LT1, I'm sure that, other exercise physiologists on the podcast have kind of talked about this. That's that first point where your RPE and the power that you're putting out and, you know, all, and the lactate especially decouples, where suddenly there's a nonlinear increase. And that can actually happen as low as like 45, 50% of FTP. And so the question is, if you're not riding at 55%, are you not doing zone two? I would argue very differently. And I know that like Steven Seiler is a proponent of this type of approach, and I am too. And I think I have been for almost as long as I've been coaching, really, where I'd rather somebody just ride easy and get back feeling like they didn't really do that much work. And the RPE with cyclists too on this is also very strange because a lot of the time we're looking for the RPE decoupling. And so for instance, if you've got a 300 watt FTP, this is indicative of a lot of my clients, and they'll ride at 200 watts all the time. And they're like, this is my zone two. And I'm like, I don't think that this is, because on your other workouts, your RPE and training peaks, like all this other stuff is telling me that this is harder than I think it should be. So I want you to pull back to give me 180 watts, give me 160. And the RPE will go from like a 6 or a 5. And as soon as we get back down under LT1, it's going to turn into like a 2 or a 3 a lot of the times. And that's where I want people riding.
So what's our best way of determining and setting these zones in the face of, you're saying Coggins is maybe descriptive rather than prescriptive? Because a lot of us are still going out the door doing a 20-minute functional threshold test and then using that to set our zones. In the absence of laboratory stuff and having an accurate, okay, this figure is our LT1, is there a field test protocol that you lean on to say, okay, this is the most effective one for figuring out actually what our zone two is?
Yeah, sure. I mean, and actually, I feel like a lot of the time, the lab tests are almost as often bad as they are good. Because you can have certain preconceived expectations about lactate values and concentrations that are actually totally wrong. Like a lot of people think that, okay, 2 millimole concentration is my LT1, when in fact that is a tool of statistical convenience for exercise scientists, let's say. And in reality, it's really about that first uptick. So you start riding and giving somebody a lactate test, and I've done my fair share. You'll see somebody at like 1.2 millimole at rest. You start them riding and it'll go up a little bit for a couple minutes. And then it drops to like 0.8, 0.9, something like that. And then as they keep riding, you're going to see a little uptick in the RPE. If you, let's say, have them ride for 5 or 10 minutes at a time, and then you add, let's say, 15 or 20 watts a pop. So we'll start at 100 watts, 120, 140, 160, 180, 200. And now at some point, if somebody's got 300 watt FTP, somewhere between 140 watts and 180 watts usually is where we see that uptick of RPE. And a lot of the time, the lactate lags. And I'm not entirely sure why. I've got theories, but nobody's really looked into this. I mean, not that anybody really would. And so to me, that RPE uptick is the best indicator. And doing kind of a long step test, a very submaximal step test, that's the best way to check. And a lot of cyclists think that riding under LT1 is way too easy. But, you know, especially if you've got a lot of time to ride and you're looking to maximize your energy investment into harder workouts, that's really where you want to be. You want to barely be brushing the pedals or feel like it, even though you're at 150 watts.
Why is it so important? I hear terms thrown around like mitochondrial efficiency. It's pretty confusing for the layperson as to why we need to spend time in zone two. Like, what's the machinery or the, you know, the underlying mechanisms that are getting built at that intensity?
So this is one that's as complicated as it is simple. Because one of the things that happens with riding easy endurance pace is it has an outsized influence on our mitochondrial density or mitochondrial content, I guess the scientific literature would call it. Because there's a couple things that get measured in the scientific literature when it comes to mitochondria. And the first one is how much mitochondria do we have if we look at it in terms of like a TEM, microscopy. And that's one way to measure it. Not a lot of studies have done that. Maybe like a handful on healthy people and barely any, or if any at all, on the highly trained. And so usually what we're looking at is markers of things in mitochondria that are roughly stoichiometrically maintained between mitochondrial, let's say, volume slash surface area and the internal quote-unquote machinery. And so that's usually called citrate synthase. And this is the entry point for the Krebs cycle. And citrate synthase is highly associated with endurance training. And there's a recent review from Granada, Bishop, and I forget the other authors, who basically looked at what's the intensity versus what's the increase in citrate synthase. And what is the most important is total volume. And so when we're looking at a training plan, and if somebody's got 20 hours to ride, more often than not, I want them riding 20 hours because regardless of the intensity, I know it's going to be more impactful on their endurance performance than if they ride 10, 12, 15.
Are there responders to this? So like, what are the markers we're looking for to know that somebody is getting a benefit from their zone two training? Are some people going to respond at faster rates than others? Like, how do you determine if somebody has done enough zone two training?
I usually don't think that anybody's ever done enough. And one of the things that...
Or maybe a better way to phrase that one is the inverse. When someone has, you know, an amount that it's like, that's an unacceptable amount of zone two for you to have done before we start learning intensity onto that.
Yeah. And this is actually becomes a question of periodization instead of, instead of like, what can we get out of somebody? Because what can we get out of somebody on an absolute level is really a question of how much time do they have to train? What's their training history? That kind of stuff. That's the stuff for like pros and, you know, independently wealthy people who just want to ride their bike all day, which is great for them. But for most folks, what happens is you actually start to hit on kind of a limit of your volume. And we can start to layer in some intensity once we've hit the ceiling of your volume, but it really doesn't seem to matter so much when we start to do moderate intensity, you know, because let's pull back for a second. Because somebody finishes up their season, road season, let's say they're done in like October, and you've got November to chill out, and then you start training again in December. At what point do you actually want to start layering in harder workouts? The real answer, besides it depends, so what does it depend on, is where do you need to be in shape and what's your training history? Somebody with a deeper training history, I'm going to want to push them harder for a shorter amount of time, like let's say 2 or 3 months rather than a slow buildup for 6 months. And somebody who is a little newer, I'm going to want them to start to, well, do fun stuff, first of all, because, you know, not a lot of people love riding easy endurance all the time. And so I'm going to want to do something fun, like maybe we'll do a little cyclocross, do some mountain biking, but we'll start to build up the low intensity at some point that just kind of makes sense for them, especially in terms of fatigue management from season to season, because if you're still wrecked in January after having finished your season in October and you're really not up for hard training yet, I don't want you training hard yet. You know what I mean?
Rodman, I know how serious you take your goal setting, whether they're fitness or life-related goals. If you're looking for a powerful ally to support you on this journey, look no further than Huel. Huel has become my secret weapon for when I don't have time to prepare a balanced meal, ensuring I get the nutrition I need without sacrificing time or taste. Plus, it stops me from reaching for the takeaway menu. I always throw a bottle into my backpack when I'm heading into the city to work, and it stops me eating croissants and junk food, you know, just generally stuff that don't support my training goals. It's handy and it's nutritious, and it's over 22 grams of protein. Huel's perfect for athletes who don't have time to cook or prepare food before a training session. It's convenient, nutritious fuel at your fingertips, ensuring you hit your daily fueling needs for your session. Huel Ready to Drink has over 26 vitamins and minerals in every single bottle. You're getting a whopping 175 health benefits. Plus, they're all natural ingredients, stuff like tapioca, sunflower seed, coconut, and more. And the best part? The flavors are amazing. 8 mouth-watering flavors. Iced coffee is in my backpack at the moment. You can get your hands on Huel Ready to Drink directly to your home just by going to huel.com/roadman. That's Huel, huel.com/roadman.
MyWeesh is hands down the best virtual cycling app for home, and it's redefining indoor training at no cost. Yeah, it's completely free. And setting up MyWeesh is really easy. You just download the MyWeesh app, connect to your device like your Watt bike or your smart trainer, and off you go. If you're feeling competitive, there are weekly races for every category from beginner to pro. Plus, there's insane prize money up for grabs. And if you've no plans to race, that's no problem. There's hundreds of free training plans and workouts that are designed to push your limits. You can join daily group rides and group workouts, and you can customize your avatar, all without opening your wallet. So go on over to the MyWeesh app and have a look around. Why would you spend on monthly subscriptions elsewhere when MyWeesh offers all of this for free? So join MyWeesh today. It's available on iOS, macOS, Google Play, Apple TV, or you can click on the link in the show notes to get started.
So that's, I suppose, we'll call that use case one, somebody who has a target event, and now we can reverse engineer backwards from that. So we can deconstruct the demands of what that event are going to be, and we can reverse engineer back and, you know, use the theory of specificity. As we get closer to that event, the demands of training are going to begin to mirror the demands of the event closer and closer. But if we shift it to a use case B, somebody who has an undefined target, they're looking to maximize their health, their longevity, their wellness, how would you approach zone two and moving away from that into the harder stuff?
This is where I start to, well, yeah, it's weird coaching somebody who doesn't have like a particular target for sure. Because a lot of the time that is the easiest way to manage a season. And so what I've found in my coaching experience is that people can usually only take up to about 6 or 7 months of like just pure building fitness before they really need to step back and take a break. And so if I think in a 6 month timeline, I'll think, okay, like if we assign a month to a different intensity, then we can, you know, say the first month is easy. Second month, we'll add in some tempo and sweet spot. Third month, we'll do some FTP and we'll start to work a little higher intensity, get people ready for the super hard stuff. You know, month four, we get super hard stuff. And then month five, we'll kind of chill out, let somebody rest, let that, you know, let them kind of consolidate all their training with through rest and easy riding and little bits here and there. And then, you know, month six, okay, sure. Like now we're on fire with your fitness, but there's a fatigue cost that you've accumulated over the last couple of months that we need to account for now.
Yeah, that makes sense. That makes sense a lot. Something I'd love to pick your brain on is the role of diet. Obviously, when we're in zone two, one of our goals is that fat oxidation goal. Should we be making...
Is it?
or is it not? You tell me.
So here's one of the things that I think is, in my personal opinion, and according to my reading of the scientific literature, is probably one of the largest misconceptions at this point in terms of adaptation signaling. Do you get better at burning more fat by burning more fat? The answer pretty clearly at this point is no, absolutely not. It's almost irrelevant which substrate you use because the signals for adaptation are not related to dietary substrate that you are using, because otherwise all those Louise Burke studies on keto in race walkers, you would have seen better endurance with them, and we didn't. And in my own experience, because of course I've got to fuck around and find out with this stuff, and through a couple very willing coaching clients who are aware of the risks and rewards for this stuff, we also find that there's no real better adaptation you get by, you know, improving your dietary fats intake to increase your fatty acid oxidation while you are riding, because you can manipulate this stuff with diet. And if it really had that outsize of an influence, we would know it by now, and we don't. So it's not there.
So do you put any weight on trying to achieve a metabolic flexibility?
Metabolic flexibility is a combination of intensity, diet, glycogen stores, you know, stress levels. So there's a lot of stuff that impacts if you're going to oxidize carbohydrates or fats. And so it's honestly, for me, it's an afterthought. I think more in terms of, besides the regular adaptive signals that we can talk about if you want, I think more in terms of energy management. For me, it's fatigue management and energy management are two of the core principles of coaching. So if you are managing fatigue, you're talking about hard workouts. How many hard workouts can I do per week? And how many, you know, how's somebody recovering from them? You know, what lifestyle factors, sleep, you know, sickness, that's going to influence the recovery or not. And energy management, especially if you've got a client who can do, you know, they're doing gravel races and, you know, their big workouts, you know, every week or two is like a 6-7 hour ride with hard efforts. That is a very big energy investment day. We're talking, you know, thousands of kilojoules. And it takes some time, you know, a couple of days to fully restock. And that's where I think about this, because if you're out on a ride and you're doing this kind of stuff, I don't want you maximizing fat oxidation by not eating. I want you eating as much as possible because it's going to improve your rate of recovery for the next couple of days. And we see this in stage races too. Like, you know, nobody's in the Tour de France going, oh, I really need to increase my fat oxidation. They're like, I need carbohydrates now so I can recover for tomorrow already.
But is there a trade-off between long-term and short-term with that? Yeah, if I'm in the Tour de France, my goal is, yes, I need to perform today, I need to perform tomorrow, I need to perform for the next 3 weeks. But is there an argument for zooming out and looking at this through your initial lens of a longer-term time horizon and getting better? Like, I suppose the question here is, what training or diet improves our ability to burn fat as a fuel source?
All training. All training. Absolutely all training. Contractions are contractions because the signals that tell us to, well, pulling even further back before the signals, there's really only a handful of quote unquote metabolic or genetic programs, we could say, genetic maps. Like most aerobic signals go through PGC1 alpha, right? And PGC, you know, the other PGC alpha is either 2 alpha or 1 beta, I forget which one it was, and PRC. And so between those three, they're kind of like the family of proteins that switch on thousands of genes and improve aerobic endurance. And that's like one of the couple signals or programs that we switch on when we do endurance training. And that's what Andy Coggin calls muscular metabolic fitness. And so the signals for this are like calcium, because our muscles are contracting, right? And who is it, calls it a duty cycle. So the more duty cycles you have and the more, you know, in the certain amount of motor units, okay, yeah, like that signals for adaptation. We build mitochondria that way. Also, disturbance of cellular energy state, which is the ratio or basically how much work can ATP do. And this one goes through AMPK. We're also looking at redox signaling. So when we have flux through the electron transport chain, we are using NADH as a kind of electron go-between. It's like a currency almost. And as we use that, we signal for aerobic adaptation through that. And the list goes on and on. And so all these signals have nothing to do with whether you're using carbohydrates or fats or anything like that. So all riding, regardless of the intensity, counts towards your total volume. And this is kind of what I was mentioning with like the Bishop Granada paper earlier. That's exactly what their meta review shows.
So has someone explored the metabolic flexibility of athletes who have a small amount of zone 2 per week versus a large amount of zone 2 per week? Do they have a difference in their ability to metabolize fat as a fuel source? Like if we take someone that has a fixed weekly duration of, say, I don't know, 10, 15 hours, And then that 10, 15 hours is maybe divided up to 80% of it is zone two, 20% of it is non-zone two, higher intensity versus someone who's maybe a 50-50 distribution.
Yeah. And actually, you know, to me, I don't even think about it as you are burning fat for a fuel source. To me, you are maintaining cellular energy state. And maintaining cellular energy state, it seems to be primarily the thing that that keeps glycogen stores around in the muscles. And it's not whether you can burn more fat.
Simplify that for us. What does maintaining cellular energy state mean?
So energy state is really how much work can ATP do? And, you know, in textbooks, and I've got like four on my desk here, like even in my textbooks, it says, you know, we've got a high energy phosphate bond. And in reality, like there's some energy in the bond, but most of the energy that ATP has to do work actually comes from what's called mass action ratio, which is keeping the, let's say the, here's a quick example. Let's say if we let the reaction run to completion on its own, we have one ATP and one ADP left, a one-to-one ratio. What's happening is ATP is like at like 10,000 or 100,000 or something like that to one ADP. And that is actually where we get the energy source. Because if we had one ATP and one ADP and it wasn't mass action ratio, this ATP, this one-to-one, would still have the same ability to do work because it's got that one bond. But in reality, that's not the case. So that's energy state. And this is maintained by having a large amount of mitochondria with a large amount of electron transport chain density and a large amount of Krebs cycle enzyme density. And you know, as this permeates the cell, you've got a temporal and spatial buffer for maintaining energy state. Because if the energy state runs out, if you run out of the ability for ATP to do work, your cell dies. And that's where, you know, primarily why we have to stop exercising when we are, you know, doing all those super hard sprints.
So if we're looking at the distribution, so you're looking at total weekly distribution of zone two, doesn't matter how that's distributed. So do I need to go and do a 3-hour zone two ride where it's just zone two and I ring fence it and protect it and don't drift into zone three or don't drift into zone one for any of this? Or can I go and do a 3-hour zone two ride with 2x20 minutes zone four? Does the presence of zone four during a zone two ride, does that dilute the effectiveness of my zone two ride in any way?
No, it actually increases the effectiveness. Because if you look at how the adaptive signals operate, they actually increase their effectiveness with increasing intensity. However, with increasing intensity, you decrease duration. And so we've got a trade-off between all the levers that you said, like how frequently can we do this? How hard can we do this? How long can we do this? And so I'm always thinking of what is my, let's call it, what's my mechanism of progress? What's the progression thing with each type of interval? If it's like VO2s, you've got to go max. And so the intensity is the stimulus. If it's like threshold or sweet spot, the duration is the stimulus rather than I've got to add more watts. Because if as soon as you come over FTP, now you have increased your fatigue burden, let's say, but you've only like by like, let's say 50%, but you've only increased the stimulus by like 5 or 10%. And so the ratio of stimulus to fatigue, it doesn't make that much sense at that point. And so that's how I usually think about programming somebody's week, is what are the hard things that they need to do, how much rest do they need, and then all the rest can be easy endurance. And basically, it doesn't really matter the distribution. If you want to do threshold intervals on a long ride, you're not going to ruin the stimulus of the long ride. You're going to improve it.
A few years ago, I saw a huge gap in the market for an app that was like a cycling coach, but in your pocket. I knew that AI was ultimately going to be the best coach in the world. And I spent about 2 years of my life trying to make this app happen. Unfortunately for me, it didn't happen. But ever since then, I've kept a really close eye on this space to see if anyone else could succeed where I failed. The Breakaway app caught my attention a couple of months ago because Christian Van de Velde, yep, the Christian Van de Velde who came fourth in the Tour de France, is one of the co-founders. And it seems that the Breakaway have created the ultimate cycling training companion, and they're bringing low-cost coaching to the masses. You'll know from listening to the podcast that my pet peeve is when cyclists head out the door with no plan, no goal, and just roll around without an objective. Don't be that guy. The Breakaway app looks at all your historic training data and it builds a plan around your strengths and weaknesses, so you're always going to have the perfect session. They also have integrations which I'm really excited about, Whoop and Oura Ring. The reason I've previously ditched my wearables is because the data just wasn't informing my training. No longer the case. Head on over to roadmantrial.com and you can download their app for free. That's roadmantrial, roadmantrial.com, and download the app for free. The link to this is in today's show notes.
How does the adaptive response to zone two training, how does that vary between fast twitch and slow twitch muscle fibers? I remember I used to race for a US team which had a split calendar, and half of the calendar or half of the squad used to go to road events. Half of the squad were criterium focused. I was like a 72 kilogram rider, so I was treading water in between the two, probably not heavy enough to perform super well in the crits, probably not light enough to do well in the hilly races. So I ended up getting sent to both of them. But there was a wisdom, or maybe a misplaced wisdom, with the crit guys that if you had too much zone two volume, that deadened the speed, that there was an adaptive response to zone two training, which blunted your fast twitch muscle fibers.
Yeah, so actually this usually to me is a signal that somebody's been riding way too hard for their endurance rides. When you get over LT1, you do a 5-6 hour ride. Some people can do that for sure. But you know, if you do that weeks or months on end, it has a definite fatigue cost, and if you're riding under that first threshold. And so to me, that's a signal that somebody's been riding too much, or that's a way to tell if somebody's been riding too hard is like they feel like it's blunting their top end, because yeah, you are accumulating a lot of fatigue. And so with my sprinters who race at a high level, you know, they're no stranger to 7-8 hour endurance rides. They do them with sprints. They do them with hard efforts. They do them with, you know, 5-minute efforts max throughout the ride, 10 minutes sprints, et cetera. Like they do the whole gamut, and their endurance is fantastic to the point where one of my clients actually was his team's best sprinter. He's got an 1900 watt sprint, even at the end of a race. He's got a 400 plus watt FTP. His LT1 is about 350 watts. And he was their best diesel by a mile also. And they used him for pacing the peloton to the break, like managing that gap, rather than riding for him in sprints, because he was the only one who could really do that. And so I've got a sprinter here. I've got many sprinters who ride a lot, and it doesn't affect their quote unquote speed. And so when it comes to fiber type, there's a lot of questions around this, because the primary question is, does fiber type determine metabolic capacity or capacity for endurance? And the answer is really sometimes, but not really. Because there was a paper a couple of years ago looking at fast twitch versus slow twitch fibers in cross-country skiers. And they basically had as much citrate synthase and HAD, which is an enzyme that's involved in fatty acid breakdown. And they had either the same or nearly the same capacity in their fast twitch fibers as their slow twitch fibers. Because they're very, very well trained. And so you can have a fast twitch fiber that's really well trained. It just depends on the training that you do and your natural propensity for having fast or slow twitch fiber types. And so with the open data that we have in the literature, I've done this myself, where I plot what's somebody's FTP relative to their fast twitch blah, blah, blah as a percentage of their VO2 max. And there's absolutely no relationship whatsoever. So it's a complicated question, but the answer is really that there's not a relationship.
Yeah, that's interesting. That's very interesting. We talked about those two use cases. The use case one, where somebody's targeting an event, like you're saying, your guys who are, you know, getting ready for pro races, and the use case two, where they're not. I'm wondering about minimum effective dose. I read a paper recently, I think it was Inigo Samalan also shared it on his Twitter account, about mortality rates and step count. When you look at step count going from 0 to 5,000 a day, when you make that move from 0 towards 5,000, there's a massive reduction in overall mortality rates. And that's seen all the way up till about 12,000. There's a pretty significant reduction in mortality rates. From 0 to 12,000 steps a day to 35,000 steps a day, there's an improvement, but it's very minuscule after you get past 12,000 steps a day. Is there similar type rationale we could draw around zone two training for someone who's looking to maximize their longevity? What's the minimum effective dose, I suppose, is the question.
I think you're going to have to get somebody else on the podcast for this one, man, because I have no idea. I mean, this is, I am a high performance coach. That is what I do. We coach very few people who are just looking to maximize health and longevity. So I really don't have a good answer for you on that one, because it's really not in my wheelhouse at all.
I wonder, do they often pull in different directions? Is there what's good for high performance isn't always good for longevity? Or do you ever stop to ponder that?
Oh, yeah. I mean, sure. I mean, how many people, you know, in high performance situations either get exercise induced asthma, or they've got cardiac issues that, you know, that potentially get built up, or you know, the strain on the cardiac system uncovers underlying issues. You know, I've had a couple strange heart episodes myself, and you know, and so I know what that's like, and I understand why some people might be like, or some cardiologists might be like, you need to quit cycling like right now. Like what's his name? Sven Nys's guy, Albert. You know, he had to quit for the same reason. And Eddie Merckx had a congenital heart issue too, as far as I recollect. That I remember the headline. It was like you know, sort of Damocles hanging over Eddie Merckx's head for his entire career. I was like, oh shit, we're lucky we still have him, you know?
So when you're looking at somebody's zone two progression over the course of the year, what's the physiological markers you're looking to benchmark that improvement? Say, okay, they started out here, now they're here.
We've got a couple things, because I think of their endurance pace kind of on a continuum with all the way up to like FTP endurance, let's say. And so FTP endurance, by that I mean like what's usually called TTE in WKO5, like time to exhaustion, how long can you hold it? And so to me, you know, that is a marker for sure. So like if you can hold your FTP for an hour, a lot of people cannot, or you can hold it beyond an hour, which is awesome. You definitely have better endurance than if you couldn't do that, for sure. So besides that, I'm looking at any markers of fatigue resistance. Does somebody feel strong at the end of a race? Does somebody feel strong at the end of a 5-6 hour ride? Does somebody have strong max intervals throughout a ride? There's a lot of ways to do this. And also you've got to, in some ways, separate training from racing, because, you know, you can ride easy endurance for 3000 kilojoules and then smash a 5-minute effort and go, wow, my fatigue resistance is great. But then you can race for 3000 kilojoules and that 5-minute effort might be down 50 watts. And so you've got to kind of differentiate those two as well. And so those are usually kind of how I do it, along with client feedback, because that to me is also one of the big things that you need in coaching, is somebody telling you how they're feeling.
And how much weight are you putting on hard data points versus subjective analysis of how people feel? Is it down to their experience? Because I know I've had that experience lactate testing in a local club, and you're looking at somebody and they're already at 4 millimoles and you're expecting their RPE to be, you know, 7 or 8 out of 10. And you're saying, well, subjectively rate your RPE, and they're like 1 out of 10. And you're like, well, that's just not true. You're not at 1 out of 10. Then you give them another 20 watt increment and they're gone. Like they're done. Their lactate spiking up 11 and they're cooked. So there is a experience element in interpreting subjective feedback.
I think your lactate example is a little strange there. I'm not sure how it relates entirely, but, or actually maybe you want to dig into that for a second, because, you know, you're talking about somebody's feedback. Like this is one of the shortcomings of lab testing to me, because especially with lactate, like here's a quick, for instance, is I consulted with a world champion pursuiter a couple of years ago. I can't name who, but somebody with a massive engine, massive watts, big speed. And he said, my FTP or my threshold determined by lactate testing is, I feel like it's 50 watts higher than this or more. And it was a lactate test with 3-minute steps. And, you know, based on where the inflection point was by DMAX method or the 4 millimoles, whatever you want to call it, it looked like it was like 350-ish watts. And in reality, it was like 400 something. And that is one of those things where the test does you dirty. And so you can't really use a test like that for lactate, because originally that test came from conveniences for exercise scientists, where you are doing a VO2 max test and you want to get somebody to max within about 8 to 12 minutes. But if you measure lactate at the same time, you can get a pretty good idea for the population about where their second threshold is. But in reality, individually, it falls short, because the individual is not the average. It's the fallacy of division, right? So like if the average person is, let's say, 5'7", the average man is 5'7", you make a suit that's 5'7", you go, oh, okay, this fits everybody. And, you know, you look like a taller guy, you're probably like 5'10" or 6 foot, and you're going to be like, this suit, I look like I'm, you know, in one of my kids' like suits, like this doesn't fit me. And the same thing happens with these tests. So does that make sense?
Yeah, it's a very good point. I talked to Olaf Bu, the triathlon coach, on the podcast. He's coach for Gustav Iden and Blumenfeld, two of the best triathletes in the world at the moment. And he said a huge problem in his experience with coaching at the moment is bad data at a base level. So we're making bad assumptions off bad data all the way through. And Jay Vine was on the podcast not too long ago, and he changed up coach because his previous coach was working using the inside testing protocol. And he said the problem was this was estimating his FTP to be crazy, 480 watts or something, which on paper sounded amazing and maybe contributed to him getting a UAE contract. But in reality, it meant he was DNF on every single training session that he went out to do. He couldn't complete a training session. So it was leaving him just mentally crippled coming home, like feeling like a failure after every single session.
Yeah.
Bad data is a real big problem, I think, for us.
Yeah. And I mean, and I think a lot of folks forget, and I was a victim of this for many years too, especially while I was in school and immediately afterwards, is, you know, I thought that everything that was in the scientific literature was all. And, you know, after, I don't know, a couple months of coaching people, you start to realize that there's a very large discrepancy between what's in the scientific literature and actually what you are seeing out on the ground. Like rubber on the road, boots on the ground, whatever you want to call it. There's a difference between these two things. And so the original purpose of exercise physiology, going back to A.V. Hill in like the 1920s, like discovering VO2 max and all that stuff, it was trying to understand the underlying markers of performance, but it was never necessarily to say we should improve this, therefore performance will improve, because, you know, we've seen how many people blow a massive, like, you know, 9,800 VO2 max and they can't compete in a cycling race because they don't have the endurance. And so VO2 max isn't all, and threshold isn't all. You can have somebody with a massive threshold, but they can only do it for, you know, they only ride 2-3 hours. They don't have the genetic capacity or the training history to have big endurance. And they're not going to make it to the end of a race because they just fall off a cliff.
Going back to our time-crunched athletes, because I feel like that's a lot of the podcast listeners that are tuned into this right now. Somebody who's watched the Steven Seiler conversation where he's a strong advocate for 80% of our training at a lower intensity, zone 2 type intensity, and 20% of it above that. Somebody's looking at their total weekly available training time and they're like, I just don't have that many hours. I've got 8 hours, I've got 10 hours a week. And if I distribute 80% of that time to zone 2 training, it's just not leaving very much total workload to get through. So in place of that, they're starting to get creative and figure out how to hack their lifestyle to get some more movement into their day to create that zone 2 adaptation. How effective is substituting in walking into this equation to supplement that for someone like that?
I don't have any hard data on this, but in my experience, it's very effective. One of my personal friends said, you know, he can't add more riding time, but he's been doing a lot of hiking, like with his dog. And he says that it's had a really profound impact on his endurance capacity. And so any movement is good movement. And it really goes to show that, you know, kind of at the foundation of it, you know, we're looking at contractions and, you know, and redox demand, like having electron transport chain flux. Like these are big markers of improving metabolic fitness. And in a lot of ways, they're markers of improving cardiovascular fitness as well. And so it definitely has an influence. But, you know, one of the things about like 80-20 or you know, like having a rule of thumb like that is it's a rule of thumb. And once you understand the rule and you start to poke around and say, okay, what works better for me rather than I've got to strictly adhere to this rule, that's when you can start going, all right, maybe I can do 2 sessions a week that are hard, 3 sessions, 4 sessions. And I've got a client who does about 10 hours a week. He's got 3 recovery days and he does, well, 2 recovery days proper, 1 easy endurance day. And some weeks we'll have 4 hard workouts and other weeks we'll have 3 hard workouts. And he's recovering well. He's progressing really well. And, you know, also he's, you know, a little bit genetically gifted with this stuff, but not to the point where it's bonkers. You know, he's not going to be in the world tour, especially, you know, in his mid 40s. But at the same time, like we started with conservative estimate and we started to push a couple more hard sessions and manipulating how many hard efforts are we doing? Like what is the stimulus of the hard effort? Like, you know, we'll keep the VO2 max sessions max. Maybe we want to do 3 efforts instead of 4. You know, we'll keep the threshold stuff as it is. We'll add time and zone there. And between all that stuff, we're seeing some really good movement. And it's something that you've got to, individualize for yourself. Because no matter, like I said, that you don't want to fall for the fallacy of division here.
No, and I think individualize is the key word there, because I can think of, you know, I think we can largely park genetics for someone who's, you know, that limited duration. Sure, I think lifestyle factor is probably a bigger role in it than underlying genetics. Like if you take somebody who's a highly stressful sales job and cortisol levels are just maxed every single day, stressful commute in and out to work, they're a lot less capable of taking on those hard sessions in the evening after a day of just stress to the max than somebody who's of other clients who are just chill all day long. You know, they're putting in a full work day, but they're coming back basically more relaxed than when they left in the morning.
Yeah, no, like stress, lifestyle factors, sleep, nutrition off the bike, all this stuff has a massive, I would say, for what people expect, the influence is outsized. And so I actually talked myself out of a client once with this, because he was like, he's a high powered lawyer. And he said, I do every training session perfectly. And I've been seeing this amazing doctor, but my cortisol levels are a little high. And I'm looking at his files and I'm thinking, I don't see any progression with this guy. I actually am seeing regression at this point, even though he's saying everything's going well, he's doing all the sessions. So I told him, like, you know, you may be doing all the sessions perfectly, but to me, that's only 50% of what you're doing. The other 50%, you're not doing very well at all. And so I would give you a 60% for your total cycling grade, because 40% off the bike is terrible. It's really terrible. It's too much stress, not enough, definitely didn't eat enough. And I said, you know, you've got to, or this is one of the things that we're going to have to do, is we're going to have to dial in all this off bike stuff. And he didn't want to hear any of that. He wanted to hear that I've got some magical training sessions that regardless of the recovery, yeah, are going to make him amazing, as good as he wants to be. And I was there to tell him, like, we are not seeing eye to eye on this.
Yeah, it's the non-glamorous accumulation of this tiny habits off the bike that makes such an oversized difference that people don't want to acknowledge, because like you say, it's not a magic bullet. Kind of on that substitute and walking, I always wondered, at what ratio should you substitute stuff across? And this initially became a consideration for me when I traveled to Canada. And I remember traveling there and my bike didn't show up. My bike didn't show up for like a week. And I was coached by Team Sky Rider at the time.
This must have been before AirTags, yeah?
Yeah. I was coached by Team Sky Rider at the time, Mike Barry. And he's like, you know what? Just buy a pair of runners and get walking. So I was doing like 4 to 6 hour walks every single day for a week. But then I was like, well, how do I keep my training peaks updated? And that question, I think, is still as relevant now for somebody who is very time crunched and they're saying, okay, well, I'm going to get 2 hours walking a day because I can walk to work and I can walk home from work. Does that substitute for my zone two riding? And if so, does it substitute in a one-to-one ratio of my zone two riding?
That's actually a very good question. And I am not entirely sure. I don't have a lot of clients where that is something that we really lean on. I do have a lot of clients where, especially in the winter, there's a lot of cross training. People live in Canada or like Northern Europe where, you know, skiing like downhill or cross country or even in Colorado, like this is a big thing. And if they don't want to get onto the turbo for 2 hours, you know, on a Saturday, it's a perfect day out to go cross country skiing. I want them to go do that instead, because at the very least, I want them to enjoy their training rather than going, oh, I got to slog through this 2 hour session. And, you know, I've run out of John Wick movies to watch.
So how do you approach keeping that updated on their training peaks?
I usually let them use heart rate TSS, but honestly, I just think about it in total volume. It's really nothing magical. I just look at over on the right column where it says total training time for the week. I'm like, if it says, you know, 10 hours on the bike and 14 hours total, I'm like, okay, about a 14-hour week, give or take. It's not an exact science, and making training and coaching an exact science, I think is kind of a mistake. It's missing the forest for the trees.
Yeah, well, I think we all fell for that at the start, didn't we? Every one of us had a training partner when power meters came out at the very start. And they're like, I can't go above 205 watts. So to get dropped on every single drag. And then they drill it past you in icy conditions on every single downhill to keep their 200 watt average. We all had that dude in our group.
I was that dude for a while.
Finishing up, Collie, what are you excited about in the way of advancements in innovation? I know we had a little bit of a setback with Super Sapiens going under recently, and apparently they were working on a continuous lactate monitor as well, which I know I was excited about. Is there any other advancements like that you see around the corner that you think could be transformative?
I mean, honestly, not at the moment. I didn't even think that that stuff was that transformative. I think it had some really, really good benefits for a lot of people, especially the continuous glucose monitors. It would show people things like, you know, if you eat at the wrong time before you start a race or a ride, you're going to bonk because of the, you know, the simultaneous draw on exercise and insulin and stuff like that. But, you know, besides that, or just showing people like, oh, like, look, you're bonking. Look, and you should have eaten something 20 minutes ago on this ride. Like, besides that, which is stuff that we don't necessarily need a CGM for, I don't find a lot of utility in things like that, because there's stuff that we could coach people to without that those tools. And you know, the way we coach, it's heart rate, power, cadence, RPE, speed, like all the usual stuff, and it's nothing fancy, because you know the basics are the basics, and if you get the basics right, all the other stuff is gravy. You know, if gravy is even something that you need in that meal, for instance. So like a continuous lactate monitor, while it sounds awesome, it lags. Lactate lags. And especially if you've got a stochastic effort, like you're in a road race, your lactate has fuck all to do with what you're doing at this moment, the same way that your heart rate has fuck all to do with what you're doing at that moment, because the heart rate lags too. And so, and because, you know, especially with lactate, you've got rate of appearance and rate of disappearance. And a lot of organs will consume lactate, and a lot of you know, muscle mass can produce lactate at large rates, and there's a lot of blah, blah, blah with that. And it's, you know, it's not going to be like, oh, my lactate's at 11, but I feel fine. I shouldn't go with this attack because my lactate's at 11. Like, no, you should go with that attack. Like, it's been hard, obviously, but make the race.
Collie, I've enjoyed this conversation a lot. Thank you for your time.
Thanks, Anthony. Been a pleasure.